Type Radio.
Just my type.
You're listening to Type Radio. My name is Donald.
I'm Lisa.
We're at the Imaginate Conference in Bologna. It's November 28, 2008. And with us is Brian Lucid. Welcome.
Thank you.
Are you religious?
No.
Do you have rituals?
I suppose. Some.
Such as?
I would say more habits, but I'm not superstitious in that way.
And what sort of habits do you have? Even the embarrassing habits, go on.
Embarrassing?
Preferably the
embarrassing.
I touch my face a lot, I think. You know, these I'm tactile. I'm constantly having to touch things. And if I have nothing in front of me, then I wind up sort of groping my own face, I find.
So you must feel comfortable in Italy, right?
Apparently, yeah.
And this is also like one of the reasons maybe that you're really involved in interactive design, is that really?
I think so, this gesture language, you know, you can't stop the hands.
How do you relax?
How do I relax? I don't relax. This is something that people constantly yell at me about. I'm still in that place where I'm almost always engaged. Often I'm most comfortable when I'm behind a computer. So, for example, on the flight over here, I was trying to sort of write new software. and that's a way to make my sort of brain relax and turn off and focus on new things.
How did you become interested in graphic design?
I, in the most embarrassing way possible, I was accepted into a very good art school, and I'm still not sure why. And I decided that I should probably go because it was better than any of the other schools that I had applied to as a college. And when I got there, I found that my skills were better as a synthesizer, as someone who brings multiple things together as opposed to creates new things. I was not a very good fine artist, so to speak. And I naturally found graphic design through the photocopy machine. I was fascinated by photocopying things and adding them together. And went from graphic design into actual type design. And had fully expected to spend the rest of my career doing type design. And when I graduated, I discovered that you couldn't make a living doing type design. and then,
but you tried, right?
But I tried, and I designed today sort of typefaces I wouldn't consider very strong, but when I was 18, I developed two typefaces for the Font Bureau, and which I get royalties for. I get about $100 a year.
Do US you still American get dollars. Royalties?
I still get royalties from them, and the Type Foundry that I worked with has actually always been an incredibly supportive organization, and has always really kept me connected to type design, which I really appreciate. But I drifted away from it. But the biggest lesson that I learned was that when I was designing type, I was really designing software. And that group, it was the Font Bureau, introduced me to web design. And that brought me to interface. And so I went from designing letters to designing interface and designing software, and that's where I've been ever since.
And would you consider then redesigning the software for type designers, or do you think that is?
I think there's a it's such a specialized discipline that I'm not sure that I would be the one to design it. I think that you know, people like the people that do Font Lab and things like that are very tied into what they would do. Although I was thinking today that I'd be very interested in a type design software that allowed you to, say, carve styrofoam and allow that to be translated into Bezier curves, because that's something I could understand in terms of shaping letters. Mm-hmm. The physical act of drawing with the Bezier pen. Even though, you know, like all type designers, we eventually find a certain facility with it. It's such an abstract process. And I've always sort of wondered if other tools may be more appropriate. But they would be radically different tools. They wouldn't be subtly different tools.
What is the program that you were talking about yesterday?
Fonstruct.
Fonstruct.
Have you seen that? Fontshop was, it was developed by Rob Meek, and Fontshop is now financing. It took on the project, and it's basically, it's an online module, and you can build your fonts.
And it, piece by piece?
Yeah, just, and it, like, there's different building blocks, and it's basically like type design for beginners.
Interesting.
But it's really easy to use, and so it depends on your knowledge of type design, how your final design will look. And you can put fonts up for remix, and then other people can take the design and sort of start working on it and develop from there. So this whole community developed out of this little program online.
I was very influenced by W.A. Dwiggins, you know, the American type designer. And I've got this wonderful little book by his by him, which was actually sold to me by the college library. And apparently it's worth a great deal of money, but they sold it to me for a quarter because they had extra copies. And it's a letter in which he describes his process. And what I always found so fascinating is he describes the process of type design as developing a series of templates out of cardboard and then mixing and matching them. And I found, you know, as a young type designer sort of trying to learn this art, sitting behind a computer cutting and pasting all day, that I found this sort of wonderful connection, this sort of, so he was doing it too. It didn't just, it wasn't something that grew directly from calligraphy.
Hmm.
One of the challenges that I always had as a type designer, as I suppose as opposed to a calligrapher, is I'm left-handed. So I don't have that, the calligraphic background. I come from a constructed letter background. And when I saw that, I found it very exciting. And it seems like this software is sort of an extension to that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in, I'm interested, but I haven't seen too much work done in it, and I'm not the person to pick it up. But areas in terms of like what's the new space for typefaces? If we're dealing with typefaces inside this computer, we now have time, we have sound, we have meaning, you know, we have computation. And I remember years ago we had typefaces like Beowulf and Burroughs by the Let Error guys. And I would love to see more work in that sort of sphere, because I think that there's certainly that starts to take advantage of the computer as a medium for typography, and I haven't seen too much of that. Although I have to admit, it's not an area in which I'm not knowledgeable of anymore. But has there been a lot of work since since those kinds of original? I think they were Type 3 typefaces.
Right.
I'm not sure.
You're a professor in Boston.
I am.
You said a little something about like the switch from design or development into teaching. Was that a logical step for you?
It was. And I think that's because a great deal of my design has always been, and is particularly focused on now, around the idea of information design. And I think that my students quickly come to learn that sort of a great deal of design is teaching. How to make the complex clear, and how to share ideas, how to package ideas and share them with other people. So the act that they're going through and the act that I'm going through are really parallel acts. Some of my primary classes are classes in information design, where I'm really asking them to learn about something and to, and then take an editorial process to then reveal it to others. And in the service of others. So as I started moving into that as a discipline and as a body of work, teaching just seemed a very sort of natural extension to that. I still try to keep a very a good balance between sort of professional work. I've never really stopped working professionally, but the professional work that I do has changed, and the teaching that I do is still very consistent along sort of the general types of education that we do. So whereas I don't do too much print design anymore. I do a lot of interactive design. I do interface design, and I do strategy and information architecture. I find that fuels my teaching, but of course, within my teaching, a lot of the traditional skills, many of which I no longer do professionally, I still feel like there's a foundation and a basis that we need to share. And that's where a lot of the ideas from the talk today came from, is that how do we find this balance between the things that we've always taught and the things we need to teach, and these new areas in which we need to allow students to develop and grow into, and how do we find the bridge between the two?
In your university, is there a choice between print and interaction design, or you enter and you do both?
At my institution, we do both, and that's by choice. I've seen schools that create tracks, and what I've found is that today, certainly clients don't see the difference between the two. You know, they're looking for someone to communicate for them, and they're interested in finding someone who can communicate across a wide variety of media. So, students today, well, as an example, I had a Type 1 class. And this is where they learn the basics of typography. They learn type specification. They learn basic spacing and the forms of the letters and how to join them. So essentially, from letter to word to sentence, for example, at that level. And so on the first day of class, I walk in and I say, how many of you have ever set typography, have ever done fine typography before? And one of them raises their hand. Okay, I've done a little bit of what I would call type. And then I said, how many of you have done HTML and CSS before? And about 70% of them raised their hand. So we have a classroom of students who have designed rules that are applied in real time to content to create form on the internet. But they don't see that as in relationship to, say, something like typography. So they understand it in a digital form, but they don't understand it in a print form. So we're getting a generation of students that don't really see the difference between, say, print and interactive. They just see them as sort of different places to apply them. I have graduate students, and I'm fascinated by this, because I went through a fairly traditional design education, who were trained only as interactive designers. And when they come to us and they're required to design a book, they're lost because they've never moved into that space. So our goal is to deal with the issues, the foundational issues of design and form, et cetera, and how they apply across all media. So from the sophomore year on, they're thinking about typography on screen, typography in print, relationship of image, time, all of these kinds of processes. And to a certain extent, even subtle relationships of sound, although we're certainly, that's not part of our program. It's something that we're finding that we can't leave out. So, you know, they need to have a sort of an awareness of the totality of sort of communicating within motion. And it's not just a purely visual experience, so they need to have a little bit of both.
So in a four-year curriculum, they learn type, they learn about print and interaction. Isn't that too much?
It's a tremendous amount, and I would say they even learn more. What our students go through is an education in typography, in both print and screen, and then they go through a fairly rigorous curriculum of information architecture, which at its core is really non-visual. It's an editorial process. How do we organize and structure content? Now, of course, that has a direct relationship to typography. This is something typographers have done forever. But we try to bring a little bit of the science to it. So they learn how to organize and structure content, mm-hmm. the editorial role of the designer, and then how that comes together and turns into things like animations that explain, or transforms into interfaces that help people get the information they need. So they're learning all of these things sort of alongside. So typography, form, color are sort of formal attributes that they're gathering as they're being asked to sort of do these more sort of communication-based sort of problem solving, all the way through to the senior year, where they're asked to sort of do sort of a thesis project, some sort of a cell phone project. And that's where we're seeing them start to take off in these interesting directions. As I mentioned, design systems are very important in our curriculum. This is something we're trying to integrate from the sophomore level up to understand the wide range of systems, both formal and conceptual and social and cultural, that influence their work. And we find that as they start to really dig into these sort of relationships between things, that's what starts to move them away from sort of the artifact, not to use it in a negative term, but more towards areas of experience design. And that's usually happening at the senior level, so before they graduate.
And what is, for example, between when you were studying and now that you were teaching, what is the one, say, the similarity? There's what connects the two?
What connects the two?
Like, or is it completely different? Do you think if you went to college now, it would be as if you were studying something completely different, that teaching or education has changed so much that you can't compare?
I think the core of communication is the same. I think perhaps in some ways the way we evaluate communication has become more detailed and fine in terms of saying, is this successful or is this unsuccessful? But the heart of it is still there, you know. I think a lot of the models we use are very much the same, the critique model, et cetera, et cetera. So that, you know, if I was to walk into a class, it would very much look the same as it was before. But I think the things that the students make, even in terms of print, are fundamentally different. I mean, the Epsonization of design education. You know, certainly when I went to school, we weren't able to work in color at all. You know, we just didn't have access to that. So it was primarily a black and white design education. And the color primarily came once we moved into industry and were able to learn and had resources to do this. And so students are immediately have access to things that we would have never had back then.
Do you give them assignments in that way, like for this next assignment you can only use black and white? Is that like one of the restrictions you could?
We do. And this is an area where I'm torn. So it's something that I think a lot of us are still experimenting with. Traditionally, that's how we've done it. You know, say if we're teaching typography, we'll you know, one typeface or two typefaces. But you know, there's this very interesting. I'd love it to be more of a conversation. But this idea of complexity, and this idea that in the past. And in many ways, I'm sort of quoting Meredith Davis, who's a very well-known American design educator. You know, that in the past, complexity has been seen as this thing that we're trying to wash away. You know, the designer's job is to remove complexity. It's to narrow things down to the simple statement. Of course, the problem is that's a great flattening of content. You know, there are some things that cannot be simplified. They exist in complexity. And if that's true, then we need as designers to sort of look and say, perhaps we're not teaching this in the right way. How do we teach these things in a symphony of managed complexity? You know, so in the past, it was about simplifying complexity. And today, it's about learning to manage complexity. So how do designers manage complexity and make it clear for others? That's part of what we try to teach in our information architecture classes. The students never grasp that at that level, but that's really where our attempt is. You know, perhaps with typography, maybe that still stands, but perhaps not. You know, I saw a wonderful lecture recently by a faculty member at NC State who's looking to teach typography in terms of relationships. So typography is always taught as a system of relationships of all other objects, both formal and then conceptual and then cultural. And in that way, it's never simplified into its most simple points. And complexity is taught through the entire aspect. And that interests me greatly. And I'm curious to see the results of that. Again, it's this relationship of the complexity plus the word has fallen out of my head, but this apprenticeship model. And, you know, does that still really function? And perhaps it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it doesn't.
Asking about the future of this technology and, the interface and how this will develop, do you think maybe that we are not the generation that will live to see even comprehend the beginnings of that development?
I think not. I think I'm at the tail end of it. You know, I see myself as a fairly computer savvy person. You know, but I got my first computer when I was a junior in college. You know, so interestingly enough, my design education was almost purely digital in that sense at the very earliest stages. You know, I never did traditional paste up. I'm probably one of the first generations of designers who were never asked to go through that kind of formal education. But, you know, today the students that we have always had, I mean, to them computation, they don't even think about it. It's just natural. From computer video games, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a very comfortable world for them. And it's that kind of facility that is probably going to create greater change. So in many ways, my job is to sort of frame the problems for them and show them those relationships. But my hope is that, you know, it's funny. I mean, like this is a true hope of mine. I see us in the incunabular years of interface. And whenever people start talking about standards and structures for interface, I get nervous because I have a true belief that there are things out there that are so much better than what we have today.
Which we don't know about yet.
Which we don't know about. And so the last thing I want to do is stifle innovation. You know, so this idea of accessibility is a very powerful one. And it's something that we teach within our school. But at the same time, I also want them to be able to go off on flights of fancy and then return back and to say, well, what can we learn from these things and what are the possible new directions? I think that level of creativity is a really important one because it's far too early to start defining such things. You know, it's far too early to do that.
Okay, maybe a simple question, but you always refer to complexity. But what exactly, what is more complex now than, say, 5 years ago? What is, when you refer to complexity, what is it?
I think there's a variety of scales we can look at it. And not all of these scales are places where graphic designers can immediately plug themselves in and make change. However, I think we're starting to see a variety of products that have a much wider sort of vision cycle than before. So the example, you know, that I gave was the iPod. You know, we have an interface plus software plus a network that delivers content plus someone creating licensing relationships. You know, without all four of those, the object doesn't work. I mean, the object is still beautiful and aesthetic, but it fundamentally doesn't work. So, you know, the wider back we can see these problems and say, okay, so to create this product, you know, we're going to need to have lawyers and software engineers and interface engineers, you know, and this whole package is what really makes this a successful product. The ability to have that kind of vision fascinates me, you know. I don't see that as purely the future role of design. But I think that as designers can start seeing areas where the things they make affect larger issues of whether it's economies or culture, and start realizing that that's a place that they can plug themselves in and start making change. We're starting to see, I think, very interesting curricula using design language to teach non-design subjects. I find that very interesting.
How does that work?
Tying into things like the design process, tying into using more of our methods of learning. So moving, for one, tying into visual learners, but then, you know, tactile learners and things like that. And sort of understanding this design process of making, and then how do we apply it to teaching something like mathematics or history. So a lot of the times we think of design process and we talk about design process and use it towards making design and teaching design. But we're starting to see at both the high school level and even younger ways of thinking about this process as methods of teaching others. So I don't think the complexity is new. I think the complexity has always been there. I think that in many ways, very savvy designers have always been aware of it. Maybe this is a good example. Maybe it's not. I'd be curious what you think. I had a graduate student come to me about a year or two ago and asked me this wonderful question. And this was in the United States, and I'm not sure if it's the same here in Europe. But he said, "Brian, where did all the old designers go? When I go into a design studio..."
We're here.
He says, "When I go into a design studio, I see people who are in their 20s and 30s. But I don't see anyone who's in their 40s or 50s or 60s, except for the few people who own design studios. Where does everyone else go?"
I have that same question. And it worries me.
It's a great question. And I think that some of these people have always traditionally moved out of the studio model and started to see things at the more systems level. So moved into things like corporate communications, into marketing, into corporations, and are still maybe in their own subtle way applying design thinking to their design problems. Of course, some of them go off and buy bed and breakfasts in New Mexico and things like that too, which is where we always joked that, you know, designers went off to retire. But I think it's a great question for those, you know, that a lot of people sort of move out of the pure design industry, but bring that education with them to other places. And a lot of them go into business and go into industry. And I think that that's very much that movement that we're talking about right now, you know, about how do we sort of stretch design into all of these different spaces. And I think it's been happening for a long time.
But it's a shame that it stretches one way, but it doesn't start from very early on. I mean, we have maths and geography at school, but there is no design education.
But there's very little design. There's very little depth in... You could perhaps say that this is a limitation of the way we've taught design. I mean, we don't... We're just getting to the point where we're thinking about these things. I mean, so much of what I think of as design education has come from personal experience. You know, we've had people who've done amazing things in design for so long, and maybe they come and teach, but there's not a formalized curriculum around it. It's based on this one person's personal experience, or this one person's personal experience, or look how this person started off as a designer and then wound up as the CEO of a corporation, and what can we learn from them? But it's not formalized in that way. And as designers, we're not very good at looking at this history and recording it, or even becoming aware of what it means. I think that's because we're so stuck in the studio mentality, and we're working, and we haven't taken enough time to step back and say, okay, well, what's really going on here?
Yeah, because I'm always curious, how does one become a designer when they've never been taught that at school? I mean, it's always like a sort of word of mouth. It's either my uncle or I saw something I liked.
There's this sort of biorhythm of it getting popular or not. You know, this decade that everybody wants to be a graphic designer.
I felt the same way for a long time until I had a conversation with my father. And my father's a lawyer. And I asked him about his education. And he said, well, interesting enough, he says, you know, I went through law school and I was never taught how to act in a courtroom. He says, that's not something they teach. They just taught the rule of law. He said, all of that stuff, which in many ways what you could say is the core of like what we do as designers, the bringing things together. He said, all of that was things that we would just learn as we go. And as designers, as design education, we're kind of in the same boat, you know. There's only so much that we can give. I think we can give a lot more than we do. And then the rest of it sort of comes together. But, you know, as a discipline, I think it's still a very young discipline. I think it's not a very codified and structured discipline, perhaps on purpose. But these things that we're talking about, I think we're just starting to be aware of them. And, you know, I think we're developing a clearer sense, I would hope, as to how to teach this as a wider view. I think there's already some really wonderful models in terms of teaching some of our core skills, you know, in terms of form and those kinds of languages. But the wider view of how it's applied and its influence, et cetera, we still are finding our way in terms of how do we teach that in context. That's our next big challenge. And perhaps the people who are in studio are not the best ones to teach it. It is incredibly difficult, at least in the United States, to find somebody who is capable and trained of teaching a design history class. And the majority of people who do that are designers themselves who have found an interest in design history and have gone and done that research. But it's really quite difficult to find someone who is trained, you know, like someone would be trained in art history, to have a fundamental understanding of the history and context of design and be able to teach that to others. As a school, you know, we have a class like that. It's taught by one of our faculty members. But he's a designer, you know. I mean, he comes from that background, a studio background, and he does a wonderful job. But I've always sort of wondered, you know, it's quite interesting. We have so few people who are really able to teach that as a liberal art. And so you can see hints from all of these different places about this sort of lack of history, in a way. Maybe history isn't the right word, but a lack of scholarship in terms of graphic design and its application and things like that.
And it's, well, basically it all starts with an understanding of what design is and how it should work, and if you start with that, then immediately follow like content is equally important as the how it looks.
And exactly, and then at least within our program, we try to teach it across a variety of media. So, teaching the history of film and photography is just as important as teaching the history of design. Because eventually all of these things are going to come together into a point and crash together. So yeah, it becomes a quite interesting challenge, and it's always disappointed me that, you know, I mean, this is something that I would long for. This is a class I would love to sit in on. But yet there's the majority of people teaching it are people from a studio background and not from an art history background. That's not to I take away from what they do. It's absolutely amazing. But it's just interesting to note that our history is currently being recorded by us and not by others. I don't think what we do is any more complex or than what's happening in the fine art world. I would say it's quite less. But yet there's very little of that kind of scholarship going on. And it's not my place to do it. That's not my background either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a maker. I'm a studio person. So,
you see your own limitations.
And I think also my passions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the more there's something that I take a great deal of pleasure from in being able to produce and make things, and I think that's very important, particularly for a faculty member, because, you know, I need to be able to share some of that knowledge with my students and be able to work with them in that way. So yeah, I certainly do, you know, it's sort of a bit of an academic game that everyone has to play. But at the same time, I've always felt myself very much aligned to, sort of the working designer and really trying to stay within that world.
Yeah, because then afterward you're out of touch, no? Or do you think that if you didn't practice that...
Although I think in a very exciting way, many of the things that happen in the educational institution are much further beyond what I'd be allowed to do in practice. So what's kind of interesting is that in the past, sort of like education-wise, well, I don't know, perhaps not. But the kinds of research that we're allowed to do in an educational institution is very sort of exploratory and fun. And that's it fuels my professional work in the same way that my professional work fuels the school. So years ago I would say, oh, my professional work, you know, gives me arms me with things that I bring my students to give them real world experience. And today I would say that my educational work gives me a way of looking at design problems that when I apply them to professional work, it allows me to seem more creative or more open to new situations. And when working with the right client, that can lead to very, very interesting and fun projects. So it's a wonderful balance.
This is Dive Radio. Now we're talking.